This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. My name is David Allen Greer, and this is In Our Time. This podcast, In Our Time, is a podcast about technology and society, about history and engineering, ideas, and ultimately about the place of software in hardware in our age. As I produce this podcast, I often wander quite far afield as I try to understand how technology and people interact. So today, I'm going to wander into 19th century farm architecture in an essay that is entitled Barn Raising. Well, there was no question about it. It was an invitation to a barn raising. My friend Derek, the rocket scientist, who has appeared in these columns before, had sent an email to a group of his friends asking if they could spend a weekend helping him to install a solar roof on his house. It was a call to community service that we rarely receive in our age, a chance to help a friend, an opportunity to work with a team of interesting and talented individuals, a job that could make a real, substantive impact on the world rather than being merely yet one of those 10-kilometer charity walks to raise funds for some modest cause with a guilt-provoking name. The Association to Make the World Better for Oppressed Children, Tropical Hardwoods, and Arctic Seals. This was different. This was tangible. With 2 days of work, we would cut Derek the rocket scientist's home free of the local power grid and release perhaps just a few kilowatt hours for others. Well, had not my presence been required elsewhere, I would have gone, strapped on that tool belt, picked up the nail gun, and rushed to the rocket scientist's side. My time with the rocket scientist generally becomes an advanced seminar in engineering problems. He delights in uncovering how little of the technology I actually understand, even though he has asked me to serve as a witness on his drawings for patent applications. I take great pleasure in asking all those unanswerable policy questions, while I still admire his ability to convince others of the rightness of his cause. During our last visit, just a couple months ago, we spent a day wandering through a botanical garden near his home while arguing the entire time about how we might affix a solar panel to the electric tram that ran through the park. The technical problem was straightforward. The problem of convincing the park management to spend the money was considerably more challenging, though many of the staff were sympathetic to the idea. In the end, absolutely nothing came of our discussions. We made no changes to the tram, and we also passed the day without seeing a single flower in the garden. This is the kind of relationship we have. Well, the solar roof has been a much more ambitious project that has really tested the rocket scientist's full set of skills. Through email, I've been following those challenges of building permits, design approval, project finance, and several very cold weeks with no roof and no heat. I suppose this was actually more of a test to his wife, but we will move on. He has had to make cross-city trips to find specialized hardware and relied on friends near and far to get specialized devices. Long ago, the project became one of those educational opportunities that was once afforded only by the communal construction of large farm buildings. Before we had formal engineering education, or at least before we had it outside of the military, before we created learning outcomes and pedagogical standards, we learned structural engineering through communal barn raisings. Even after the founding of the first technical schools in the middle of the 19th century, American communities taught their youth how to build buildings when they pooled labor to construct large animal shelters or threshing barns for private farms. 3 or 4 times a year, the able-bodied members of the town would gather to help one of their neighbors create a building frame, raise that frame from the ground, and complete the outer walls. In holding these events, the community could reduce the cost of construction by 40-50%. They also transmitted a great deal of practical knowledge. At a barn raising, children would learn the basic skills of shaping wood, driving nails, and hanging doors. Adolescents would learn how to design a truss, how to distribute load, how to raise a frame. The young adults would get their first taste of management by coordinating labor, leading a team. When the students finally became teachers and claimed authority over new projects, they would reproduce the traditional designs that they had learned in the manner that they understood. In most regions, farm buildings had a unity of form and purpose. They were not, as one scholar noted, haphazardly thrown together by inexperienced amateurs looking for a hasty shelter, but they were carefully built by men who had the benefit of both past experience and forethought. Well, as a means of transmitting technical information, communal barn raisings began to vanish roughly in the middle of the 19th century. By 1870, they were being replaced by more systematic ways of presenting good designs, such as technical books, university experts, engineering diagrams. By the start of the 20th century, they had largely disappeared from the rural landscape. Modern barns should replace those of ancestors when necessary, explained a 1909 report on the farm economy. Because a barn answered the purpose of our grandfather is no reason for us to pattern after it. Well, Derek the rocket scientist is actually replacing the barns, or at least the house, of a grandfather or a grandfather's generation. His reviews of it were scathing. Nails were pounded into the roof at random, he wrote. They seemed to be guessing where the trusses might be. It's not likely that this project will soon be repeated as a means of mass teaching communities how to build a solar roof. The body of knowledge that forms the basis for alternative energy is already too technical to be transmitted from generation to generation by means of a communal activity and a weekend apprenticeship. When we look at how we provide information to programmers and software engineers, we quickly realize that we are barely a generation away from a time when we transmitted ideas with informal methods. And we also realize that our field has been hampered by confusion over the value of formal and informal means of communicating the lessons of experience. We must let time communicate these lessons. The 19th century farm buildings represented 200 years of experience with wood construction on the North American continent and, well, at least a millennium of similar work in Europe. The initial generation of programmers could call upon no such legacy. Engineering provided little relevant experience. Mathematics offered, well, even less. Equipped primarily with energy and vision, those early programmers created several ambitious and difficult software projects, including the semi-automatic ground environment, the SAGE control system, the original Fortran compiler, OS 360, another big project, and of course the Multics mainframe time-sharing operating system. The first generation of programmers was really an impatient lot and generally felt that they should have gained more experience from those first software systems. Software production today appears on a scale of industrialization somewhere below the more backward construction industries, complained a software designer in 1968. We undoubtedly get the short end of the stick in confrontations with hardware people because they are the industrialists and we are the crofters. Well, experience alone would not turn programmers into software engineers any more than it would transform crofters, those small-scale Scottish farmers that we idealize, into industrial managers. If anything, two decades of experience in software development between 1946 and 1968 suggested that programming might never be transformed into an industrial scale. The production of large software has become a scare item for management, noted a Bell Labs researcher about that time. By reputation, it is often an unprofitable morass, costly and unending. Scholars generally identify 1968 as a key date in the history of software engineering. In October of that year, a group of 60 senior programmers met at Garmisch, Germany, to talk about the future of their field. They discussed many topics that have become staples in the discipline: system specification, design, implementation, testing, documentation, maintenance. They also asked how people would learn to be software engineers, and how they might ever learn to master the problem that they were then calling programming in the large. One Carnegie Mellon professor, Alan Pirillis, asked, "Is it possible to have software engineers in the numbers in which we need them without formal software engineering education?" No one was willing to answer this question with an unqualified yes. Several participants wanted to distance the idea of software engineering education from both computer science education, as it was then taking form, and traditional engineering education. I am convinced that much of the game in which we are involved is one of making the best of the world around us, understanding what the world wants, and matching what science can offer, argued one attendee. That, to my mind, is truly engineering. Well, most of the group concurred that software engineering education requires more experience than could be gained from traditional textbooks and classes. Students would need to serve a term as a crofter on the land, seeing the problems faced by large programming projects. At least one professor, Edsger Dijkstra, was reluctant to embrace this idea, although he did not want to be an advocate for book learning. "We have a Dutch proverb," he said, "one learns from experience." To him, those words suggested that learning happened automatically. Well, he said, this is a lie. Otherwise, everyone would be very, very wise. Dijkstra was advocating a form of system developed that he called structured programming. And he argued that the principles of this approach should be applied to education as well. Educators should not deposit students randomly into programming projects and expect them to learn. These experiences needed to be structured so that students would learn as much as possible. Software engineering education, Dijkstra claimed, was based on practical activities, but those activities needed to be well engineered themselves. The Garmisch Conference had been called for the purpose of designing a software engineering curriculum, so the attendees considered all the usual concepts of higher education: courses, goals, assessments, all the like. However, they were unusually attentive to the task of structuring a programming team so that each member could learn all the information needed to complete the job. One professor described how to use seminars to transmit information through a group. Another suggested that programming teams should always be assembled of close friends, because then they will talk together frequently, and there'll be strong lines of communications in all directions. Others had the idea for techniques that involved, well, three-ring binders, old steel file cabinets, and fancy documentation protocols. Dijkstra, trying to argue on a more abstract level, kept returning to his fundamental idea of structure. He claimed that programmers were best able to learn from their work when the software product was well structured, and when this structure is reflected in the structure of the organization making the product. In such a structure, authority would be well delineated. The young would learn from the old. The inexperienced would gain basic skills. The novices would study algorithms, and the oldest apprentices would gain an understanding of system design. At the rocket scientists' barn raising, all parties fulfilled their roles. The technophobes carried batteries. The weekend mechanics bolted panels to their frame. The visionary leader, the rocket scientist himself, proved that he was the master of his vision. "Whoopee," he typed in the email that accounted that the roof was done. It was a heavy overcast and raining, but at 10:23 a.m., we generated power. Filled with gratitude for the accomplishment, Derek launched into a litany of thanks for all the people who helped him. His gratitude included 40 people, all with specific tasks. Looking at the list, I began to appreciate the complexity of the work, the challenges of the design, the difficulty of construction, and the requirements of local regulation. I also saw that my name would have fallen into a category on the list vaguely titled Overeducated Manual Laborer. I'm certain I would have spent a good day with good people, but I would not have learned much about the system. Black panel, black cable, black bracket, lift and carry. Keep moving so you get the job done by sunset. I had not been able to be part of the solar barn raising because I was actually in the land of crofters, dealing with problems that could only be solved by the methods of crofters, if you will. Instead of raising structures, though, I was planting words and teaching a new generation of software engineers to do the same. There are, in fact, rules for writing clear stories and persuasive arguments, but they are best learned by placing the tools in your hand rather than reading about those rules in a book or on a web page or in a clever little video presentation. The young must learn technique. The adolescents must get their structure. The leaders on the edge of adulthood must find how to manage their words. Well, as it happened, these lessons were taught in a rural classroom that stood on the edge of an old farm. The barn, which held ground at one side of the parking lot, had clearly stood for 6, 7, maybe even 8 generations. It had once sheltered old draft horses. The stalls were along one side. But now it served as a storehouse for hotel supplies. The beams had clearly been cut by hand. The frame had that asymmetric design which indicates how it's raised from the ground by a team of workers. Every aspect of the structure said that it had been built by those who had not been taught the technical aspects of design and assembly in school. Not a nail was to be seen in the structure. The children that had learned to pound pegs with a hammer on this project had taught other children to do the same when they built their own barns in other corners of the village. This pattern continued with generation following generation until one child went to school to learn engineering and taught his children to pound nails. And then the child of those children decided to learn software engineering and raise up a barn of code. You have been listening to In Our Time. This podcast is based on an essay that was published in the February 2010 issue of Computer, which is a publication of the IEEE Computer Society. More about Computer and the Computer Society can be found at the website www.computer.org. If you wish to find information about the magazine Computer, click on the Publications tab and go to Technical Magazines. Other Computer Society podcasts can be found at the site www.computer.org/podcasts. If you have any comments, we would love to hear them. You can send them to podcasts@computer.org. The music for this podcast came from Music Alley, which you can find at www.musicalley.com. As always, we are grateful for their services. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you next time.